Please be seated. Okay, we are here on the case of Malagon versus Domino's Pizza, 88603. Are both counsel familiar with the 17-minute policy where you get to argue for 2 minutes before we ask questions? Okay, great. You may proceed. Please tell the clerk how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
You already handled that. I asked for 3 minutes.
Okay, very well.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. My name is Ralph Schwartz. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Malagon Diago. I thank you for your time and consideration today on this matter. The facts of this case aren't very intensive, but the argument may be with regards to the law. So I want to first start by saying that we're here on a order by the district court regarding a motion to enforce a settlement involving my client and Domino's, who is a defendant in the case. There's also was a defendant in the case. Her name was Cicely Dills, who was the driver of the vehicle Domino's at the time of the accident. Now, what happened in this matter was that back in July of 2021, there was a motor vehicle accident, and there was a demand by my client, my former predecessor attorneys, who attempted to settle with the defendant driver, Cicely Hall, and the owner of the vehicle. What happened was is that there was demand sent. The Progressive Insurance Company, who represented both the driver and the owner of the vehicle, indicated that they were going to review the demand and get back to prior counsel for my client. What happened at that time was that they agreed to pay the $25,000 policy limits on this case, which was the limits that both the owner and the driver of the vehicle had. What ensued after that was that there was a letter that accompanied that, and in that it was indicated that they were going to pay the limits and that they had given prior counsel information with regards to the excess coverage for Domino's Pizza at the time. So the agreement that Domino's had attempted to enforce in the lower court was the agreement between my client and the driver's insurance company, Progressive. It had nothing to do with Domino's. It had nothing to do with their excess coverage. In fact, they were not a part to it. There was no meeting of the minds with regards to that settlement. There was no offer and acceptance from my client to Domino's.
Isn't the meeting of the minds, like, ultimately, you look at the actual agreement, right? And if we look at the terms of the release, it clearly includes the employer as a release party. So don't we stop our analysis there?
Well, we don't believe that it ends there, because in the case of May versus Anderson, a release is not necessary. It just needs to be a settlement agreement. And that settlement agreement was the letter of August 17th of 2021 from Progressive to my client, indicating that they, on behalf of Progressive, were going to pay their policy limits.
But didn't that letter say to sign the release prior to negotiating the payment?
It did. And prior counsel had put the check into their trust account. But it doesn't mean that because they did that all the terms of the release are acceptable.
Negotiating the check, they didn't accept the terms?
Correct. They were relying upon the terms of the letter of August 17th of 2021 that indicated that we are going to pay the monies and that it's releasing only the driver of their vehicle as well as the owner of the vehicle. Had nothing to do with Domino's, because Domino's was a separate party with a separate claim.
Right. I mean, I understand that, but didn't Progressive, in writing back and saying, yes, we'll pay you the policy limits, say, but you have to sign the release before you negotiate the check? Doesn't that indicate that's the agreement?
Well,
that's what they're willing to do.
I understand. I appreciate that. So it's our position that if that was the agreement and there was a breach of that agreement, it would have been between Progressive and my client. Had nothing to do with Domino's. The language in there had nothing to do with Domino's. The language in there had to do with their clients being released, as well as a list of other unnamed entities, which, according to Nevada state law, was not acceptable in these types of releases because it doesn't specifically identify or name the entity. So that's why we agree.
What case says you have to specifically identify or name the entity for a valid release?
Sure. there's two cases on point. One is the Boesinger case, 135 Nevada 192, as well as the Camp 4 versus Coastal Casino, which was also identified by both parties in their briefs.
Sure. Yeah, so I have them both right here.
If you'd like me to cite the specific language of what they say and what they hold, essentially that they view this type of language, this boilerplate language that's in the release, as being listing a broad class of unnamed entities, and as such, without there being any type of specificity, that those are not to be covered.
So in Boesinger, the underlying appraisal report from the appraiser being sued specifically identified the lender as the sole intended beneficiary and said no other beneficiary was intended. Right, we don't have that here, right?
We do not have that here. But what we do have is in the Camphora case, they said that basically there was a case where they identified certain third-party beneficiaries to include mortgage insurers, government-sponsored enterprises, and other secondary market participants. And what that court said is, we cannot conclude that such generic terms indicate a clear intent to confirm third-party contract rights to such a broad class of unnamed entities. And that's what we have here. We just have a broad-based name of unnamed, a broad-based class of unnamed entities that were not part of any type of negotiation, were not part of any of the meeting of the minds, were not part of any offer and acceptance, and were not part of any type of certainly consideration, because the consideration was solely paid by the third-party Progressive Insurance, and not anything to do with the Domino's people. They weren't even a part. They weren't even around. They had no knowledge of it. So what are they trying to? What Domino's is trying to do now is piggyback on the agreement that there was with the Progressive Insurance, and ignore any of their benefits to them now.
So if the release that Progressive sent, instead of saying employer, specified Domino's in there, but other than that, it had been all the same communications and everything else. Would there be a different, a different position?
It could be, because they're more named at that point. But at that point, I don't even believe that they were advised and had known that they were an actual employee of Domino's, the driver, and certainly the owner was not. But because the release intended to relieve both the driver and the owner. So even if you had the language in there that specified that Domino's was specifically released as an employer, it wouldn't have applied to the owner, because there wasn't the owner, he wasn't an employee of Domino's at that time. It was just Cicely Hall, who was the driver.
He's suing?
What's that? He's not suing. But again, it all goes to, you know, these ambiguities and distinctions in the release, which show that there has to be more than just this unnamed class of business entities to go forward in order to lock somebody else in for something that they have absolutely no interest in doing. So, and that's where this whole thing comes.
At the time of the accident, was the driver on duty? She was working in the course of her employment?
We found that out later, yes, through discovery.
Okay, so she had the Domino's cone on
Domino's
top of the
sign up, yes.
Okay.
Didn't it say in Progressive's letter she was working for Domino's at the time of the accident?
Yes, Judge, it did. But with all due respect, I mean, we have these issues all the time where the adjusters make the assumption that they're driving in the course and scope, and we found out later that there's not. And in this case, we had no information as matter.
Right. I certainly don't blame you for confirming those.
Yeah, we have an issue on appeal on that one as well. So where okay. We thought that an insurance policy applied, right, because we thought the adjuster indicated that the person was in course and scope and wasn't. So got I hope it. That answers
it,
your question.
It did. And then can you just talk a little bit more about the third party beneficiary argument? The court's order didn't go into it, but the briefing up here did. And I think the briefing down there must have also. Do they have to be a third party beneficiary in order to benefit from the waiver, if we find that waiver to be valid? Do they still have to get over the hurdle of being a third party beneficiary before they can benefit from that waiver?
Absolutely. And it was not touched upon much at the lower court level, in the sense that the order came back and just basically said, because you deposited the check, now this is a valid release, and now it's protecting everybody in there, including Domino's as the owner. So, but, you know, as for your question, I mean, there has to be, you know, the two-prong analysis, a clear intent to benefit the third party and third party's foreseeable reliance on the agreement. So in this case, we don't believe they definitely haven't filled the second prong, which is foreseeable reliance. But the first prong isn't either, because what Progressive did when they sent that letter was that we're releasing our people, but here is the information for Domino's. Here's their claim number. Here's their Sedgwick, their third-party insurer.
I kind of read that to be like the two insurers, the insurer for the driver and the insurer for her employer, needed to be on the same page so they knew what was going on. I mean, I don't read into it the intent that you're suggesting of saying this release doesn't apply to the driver or their insurer, and let us help you out with your claim against the insurer. I mean, that seems to me a stretch.
I'm sorry. I believe the Progressive release on the personal vehicle of Ms. Hall, who was driving her own personal vehicle at the time of the accident, does apply to Progressive. But Progressive has no authority over some other business entity, let alone some other insurance third-party administrator in a case where it's an excess policy.
Right, but they may have claims against each other for how they handled the claims and would prefer that everybody be on notice that this is how it's getting handled. I mean, that's how I read it.
Well, putting them on notice is one thing, and I don't know if they did or not. All they did was indicate to us, here's the claim number for Domino's and their third-party administrator, but there was nothing in there that says that this will resolve, in that letter, that this will resolve, you know, all the claims if you intend to go after the third party. It was, here's the third-party information, and basically just as an assist, you know, to go know that there's additional insurance out there that we as Progressive do not handle and do not have any interest in.
Sorry, let me just ask you this, because the language actually says, additionally, Sedgwick Insurance is providing excess coverage for this loss. What do you interpret that to mean?
I believe that in the event that the damage is warranted going after Domino's and their excess coverage, that we had the ability to do that based upon our settlement with them, that we were not precluded at all by accepting the Progressive's $25,000 and then going reserving our rights to go after it if the damage is warranted.
Right. And so did the court below construe both the letter and the release together as one contract?
They basically said that by depositing the check, that then affirms the release, making it a valid contractual document. And again,
and so they disregarded the letter altogether as part of the analysis.
I don't know if they disregarded it altogether, but the findings of fact and conclusions of law don't make any reference to that letter at all. So I don't know if we certainly provided it, and we provided the same argument, but I don't know if they considered that or not.
I have a little different question, and I don't think anybody touched on this in the briefing, so okay. I'm going anyway. NRS 17.245, effective release or covenant not to sue, says, when a release or a covenant not to sue or not to enforce judgment is given in good faith to one of two or more persons liable in tort for the same injury, it does not discharge any of the other tortfeasors from liability for the injury or wrongful death unless its terms so provide. And it goes on. Does that mean that if its terms do so provide, then it does discharge the other tortfeasor?
On a covenant not to execute?
Yeah.
It may have, but we never got to that point. We had the driver in the litigation, but then the driver got out, and we had agreed beforehand that either she was going to stay in on the covenant not to execute, or she was going to be out. So.
Right. But if the release executed with the driver who got out says that it also releases other tortfeasors for the same injury, then does not this imply that it is an effective release of that other party?
Well, again, then I think we go back to the two-pronged standard of what was the meaning of the agreement and was there foreseeable reliance upon that by Domino's. And there was not. It goes back to the broad class of unnamed entities that the Supreme Court on multiple occasions has indicated that it needs to be more specific than just that.
Right, but I'm not even sure it's a third-party beneficiary theory is the right one, because it seems to me that a driver of a car who they want a release of the employer who on whose business they were driving, so that the employer doesn't come back and sue them if the person they're paying ends up suing the employer, and the employer comes back against the employee and says, you were driving like a jerk, you owe me the money that I have to pay this person. They wanted the release to include the employer ostensibly for that reason. I mean, that's how releases work and why you add additional parties. You don't want the exposure of them circling back on you. So looking at this release and its text, had it been signed, it seems to me it's not even really a third party. It's protecting the primary party as well.
Well, that could be. I was just basically responding to their argument that that's, you know, they're relying upon the fact that they're entitled to having this motion to enforce settlement on that agreement because of the fact that that's their position on it. I would say, based upon the Supreme Court, as well as the factual information in that letter, that if they wanted their employer to be specifically released, that they had to be better identified or do something else in order to
To me, why isn't employer good enough? I know I'm eating.
I'm just going by the case law that I read to you that indicates, you know, they're unnamed entities. So if they're unnamed entities, how do we know what the agreements were between all of the parties going forward? That seems to be my reading of these cases, and it seems to be rather consistent. The two cases that they cited actually denied that broad language. They set out the
standard. Releases that people sign every day for, you know, executors, managers, officers, employees, successors, assassins, those are not valid.
Not that they're not valid, but if they're attempting to get rid of those particular entities, according to this case law, they can certainly be challenged as being ambiguous because they did not name the specific people. I mean, it goes without saying that if they, you know, if they wanted these people, they should have indicated that this is specifically who we want out. And in addition to the fact, we still didn't even get to the second prong, which is the foreseeability issue and the fact that, you know, they were not a part of it. I can't, again, the fact that some other insurance company with other insureds and everything else is trying to negotiate that settlement for Domino's, I just think is not realistic. I think they don't have the authority and wouldn't have the authority to do that if they tried to or attempted to do that. So
I pushed you into your rebuttal time, so I'll add 2 minutes to your argument, and I'll add 2 to his as well.
Okay, I appreciate that. I forgot the instruction, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, I was the one who pushed you over.
We
the
were
line.
Questioning you. That's fine.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jonathan Fountain on behalf of Respondent Domino's Pizza, LLC. I'll start my 2 minutes by saying we believe that this case turns on whether Progressive's response letter was either an acceptance, as appellant claims, or was a rejection and counteroffer, as Domino's claims. And I believe there's two very clear reasons why Progressive's letter could not have been an acceptance. And the number one reason is if we look at the offer letter, the initial offer letter by Ms. Hall's counsel, it says that Progressive has to give an affirmative representation that there's no other insurance. Well, Progressive couldn't do that because it knew there was other insurance. It knew about the Cedric policy, and it disclosed the Cedric policy and Domino's role as the employer of Ms. Hall in its August 27 response letter. So Nevada is a state where we have the objective theory of contracts. And under the objective theory, we know that the terms of the offer and the terms of the acceptance, they have to match up. We call that the mirror image rule. And Progressive's letter couldn't have been an acceptance because Progressive couldn't accept the material term of the offer. And that material term was a representation that there was no other insurance, but clearly there was. And Progressive identified that. The second reason why this response letter that Progressive gave could not have been an acceptance is because it included substantial additional material terms in the form of the release, releasing Domino's, Ms. Hall's employer, and the letter, the cover letter also said, here's your $25,000 settlement check, sign it and return it to us before it's negotiated. Under Nevada law, an acceptance that differs from the terms of the offer is a rejection and counteroffer, plain and simple. So we believe that the the letter Progressive sent simply couldn't be an acceptance. It had to be a rejection counteroffer. And so construed as a rejection counteroffer, what Progressive is saying is they're saying, okay, here's the terms we're willing to settle under today. And the terms we're willing to settle under today, $25,000, and this release that we've enclosed, that's the deal. Oh, and by the way, you have to sign the release and return it before you cash the check. So construed as a rejection and counteroffer, there was an agreement. It released Domino's. The agreement's unambiguous. I don't think we need to get beyond that. The issue of third-party beneficiary was not included in the papers below by appellant, so we believe that's waived and can't or shouldn't be considered by this court on appeal. I can get into that a little bit more if the court wants to, but that's my opening remarks. I think a really important point is that the Progressive letter did identify Domino's by name, and it said that Ms. Hall was driving her car when she was delivering pizza. So it's not like Domino's was unknown or undisclosed. So when you have a release that's offered at the same time that uses the word employers, well, Domino's was known at the time to be the employer. It wasn't a secret. With respect to the Bozinger and the Canfora cases, I think Justice Kadish rightly distinguished Bozinger because in that case, there was language in the contract that said there's only one beneficiary here, and it wasn't the person purported to be the third-party beneficiary. So I think Bozinger is distinguishable. As far as the Canfora case goes, in the Canfora case, this court held that the purported third-party beneficiary was actually listed as an intended third-party beneficiary in that contract. And here we have the same thing as in Canfora. We have Domino's mentioned as the employer in the release, and we have Domino's mentioned in the cover letter.
But what does the cover letter mean by saying that? Let me see if I can find that letter. Sedgwick Insurance is providing excess coverage for this loss. How do you interpret that language?
I interpret that as the offer letter requested a representation that there was no other insurance, and Progressive had to respond to that. And so
they said no other insurance for the drivers of the vehicle.
Well, I think it just said
Sedgwick is not the insured for the drivers. So it says this demand is also contingent on your representation that there is no other insurance coverage covering either the owner or the driver of the vehicle.
Okay, it is narrower. It is narrower.
Right.
I take it as Progressive is disclosing in good faith the existence of another insurance policy. That's not inconsistent with Progressive.
But why does it say is going to provide or is providing excess coverage? So it's not saying, hey, by the way, in response to your
gratuitously providing coverage, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
I don't think they were gratuitously providing any kind of insurance coverage. It's unclear. We don't know.
Right. So I'm just trying to put the two and two together because you're saying that that disclosure of insurance was in response to them asking you to make the representation that the driver of the car and the passenger had no other insurance. But that doesn't seem to match up to me because this is Domino's insurance.
Yeah.
Not the driver of the vehicle. So to say that's responsive to that just doesn't kind of fit together.
I understand your point, Your Honor, but I still think Progressive wanted to put that out there. And the fact that Domino's had insurance through Sedgwick is not inconsistent with Progressive making an offer, a counteroffer here. It's the master of the terms of its counteroffer. So we can say, if you want to settle today, these are the terms we're willing to settle under, and it's $25,000, and you provide this full release that includes Domino's as the employer. And you sign and return the release.
That's not what the letter says, though. And I understand what you're saying about the release, but on the face of the cover letter itself, and I understand that, let me just read this part here. So it's $25,000 in return for an executed full and final release of all claims against our insureds, Dorn Plummer and Cecily Hall. And it doesn't mention Domino's as a released party, but goes on to actually give Domino's insurance information, which seems to be incongruent with the release, which generically says employer.
The release does generically say employer. Mm-hmm. But again, Domino's was disclosed in the cover letter, and the release also has a merger clause. It says that that is the party's agreement, not the cover letter, not any other document. So I think we have to look solely to the release to see what the contract is here. I mean, the cover letter obviously provides some context, but the fact is that the appellant cashed the check. He knew what the offered terms were. He was represented by counsel, who should have been able to construe this as a rejection and counteroffer, but nevertheless cashed the check. And our position is, by cashing the check and knowing what the offered terms were, that the appellant agreed to those terms.
So your client should be able to rely on that release, even though it's not a party to the contract. How do we get there?
Oh, easy, Your Honor. In this case, Domino's is an intended third-party beneficiary because employers is mentioned in the release language itself, but they're also a donee beneficiary. And so the law of third-party beneficiaries, we distinguish between donee beneficiaries and creditor beneficiaries. And donee beneficiaries are people who basically get a gift. It's very similar to the Morelli case, where we had a settlement agreement between the husband and wife to benefit the daughter, where the husband agreed to pay child-supported college tuition for a period of time. The daughter's not a party to that settlement agreement. She's 14 at the time. She didn't sign off on it, but she gets the benefit of the child support.
I mean, we said specifically in that case that those were very special and narrow circumstances for that case, right, and Morelli?
I don't think the proposition that I'm citing is narrow. I think in the law of third-party beneficiary, if someone is named as a third-party beneficiary, donee beneficiary, they don't have to provide consideration. They don't have to sign the contract. That's the nature, that's the definition of a donee beneficiary. And those types of agreements are executed routinely.
But you have to meet the two-prong analysis for...
Sure. And, okay, let's go to that. Under the two-prong analysis, was there an intention to benefit Domino's? If you just look at the plain language of the release, yes, Domino's is the employer. In fact, appellant knew Domino's was the employer because Domino's is disclosed in Progressive's letter. If you want to look at the second prong, was Domino's reliance reasonably foreseeable? I think the briefing gets this a little bit muddled because appellant seems to argue that actual reliance was required. But it seems to me the cases say that the only requirement is that reliance has to be reasonably foreseeable. And I think it is reasonably foreseeable. I don't think actual reliance is required. So was it reasonably foreseeable that the employer of someone who got into a car accident would want to rely on a release executed by the employee? Sure, absolutely, on its face. On its face, it's reasonable.
Well, but I'm struggling a bit to even fit. It feels like a size 8 foot in a size 7 shoe, this third-party beneficiary. When you sign a release, it says you hereby release and discharge these claims against these people. And the obligation of the person who's signing it, and I get here there wasn't a signature, but once that's signed, the claim is discharged. There is no further performance that is due from the person who's the releasor. So the third-party beneficiary usually would be enforcing an as yet unperformed contractual obligation, but in this context, it's a fait accompli. Once I give you the money and you sign the release, you discharge your claim against me and everybody else.
Yeah, so I don't even think we need to get to third-party beneficiary.
Exactly. I've not thought this through as a third party, much less as a donee beneficiary, and I'm not sure we're not overcomplicating things.
Well, and it seems to me that maybe third-party beneficiary is the second side of the same coin. We have a release that's very clear. It says employers are released.
And it says right the there. Claim is discharged as against the employer.
Yeah.
That's what it says.
Right. So, you know, I think we stop right there. I mean, the third-party beneficiary argument's our position. It was waived anyway. So
sometimes simpler is better.
That's all I have, Your Honors, unless you have any other specific questions for me.
I do not. Carly?
Let me just check real quick here.
Just a moment.
Okay, no, I don't. Thank you.
Okay, very well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Does anybody else believe the third party beneficiary argument doesn't apply?
I'm still on the fence, counsel, but you can go ahead and just...
It's not clear. I have to say, I was like going round in circles in my own head about it. I did find some cases talking about it in those terms, but ultimately, it seems to me, if the release that's entered, contract that's entered, specifies that this kind of party is released, it seems to me that's like a definition of an intended third party beneficiary. It says it right there.
Well, it's an unintended third party. I mean, that's what the case.
Then why is it written there?
Because it has to, according to these cases, it has to be specific. I mean, you had the Lipschy case, which was one of the seminal cases too. It says the matter of negotiations between Tracy and Wolf, who were the two parties, the intent of the parties, and the tenor of the agreement made it plain that Tracy did not assume or intend to assume any obligation to Lipschy. So basically, what they're saying is, by entering into this agreement and without naming specifically who's coming out or who's going to be named in this release and not be and be released, they're basically saying you can't assume that obligation to somebody unless you're identifying. So I think it does apply, and they're the ones who are arguing it. But if we're just going back to what we were talking about before, I mean, I agree with some of the questioning that you had. I mean, that release specific or that letter specifically says, we're releasing our insureds and we're not releasing anybody else. So there is no writing of a release. There is no need for a release, according to May versus Anderson. It's whatever writing we're relying upon, and we're relying upon the letter that says we're releasing you or we're releasing our insureds. And here's, by the way, here's the excess insurance for Domino's. Why would they say here's the excess insurance for Domino's if they didn't think that Domino's was going to have some potential exposure down the road?
In response to his comment that you conditioned your offer on a representation there was no other insurance and they were simply disclosing that there was other potential insurance and giving you then a form of release that would release the employer and by extension the employer's insurer.
Well, as Justice Lee said, there was in that letter or in that demand a no other insurance for your insurance. This is not their insurance. This any other insurance would have been anybody's in the world, whether it was another car that hit her, Domino's people, anybody in the world. It was specifically if there's any other insurance for your insurance, we need to know about that too. And that's not the case here.
Okay. So thank you very much.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I want to thank both.